countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Have you cattle to sell? Find out what they're worth with our March price calculator on farmersjournal.ie.
Now on RTE Radio 1, time for this week's Countrywide with Damien O'Reilly.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal, bringing 295,000 readers the latest farming news and the best of rural Ireland weekly.
Good morning and welcome to the programme. Coming up between now and 9 o'clock, winner all right at the annual Food Writer Guild Awards. Cattle out and back training. We check in with Westmead footballer and farmer John Heslin. We go in search of the elusive curlew. And joining us live, the Minister for Agriculture, Charlie McConnellogue.
Text 51551. Email countrywide at rte.ie and tweet at RTE Countrywide.
But first, the slightly warmer weather, blooming flowers and greening leaves mean that for many it's time to get back into the garden to plant seeds, shrubs and plants. And with restrictions, despite that, people are flocking to garden centres and nurseries to stock up. And so we begin this morning in Virginia, County Cavan, where I popped along to meet well-known local nursery owner Donal McAvoy at his Pergona Nursery.
Damien, you're very welcome to Pergola Nurseries, Virginia. It is a lovely day. I'd say you love this time of the year, do you?
We love this time of the year, but we're getting frost at night, Damien, you know, so that's proving a bit of a challenge these nights. And, of course, frost at this time of the year gives us a strong sun the next morning, which can do a lot of harm. So we're covering up plants and trying to caution people from buying things and putting them out because not everybody realises it was frosty last night and the night before, you know, and the unseasonably low temperatures.
And of course, there's a huge interest in. So how has the last year been for you, Donal?
Last year has been up and down roller coaster, as it has been for everybody. In March, we had to close our doors for the first time last March. We're here since 1986, so that was a bit of a shock and a very quiet nursery after we closed. So we didn't know what to do. So within a few days, we turned our Instagram page into a shopping page, and it marched on from there, and now there's a proper web shop set up. We kept all the staff here and we're packing away and everything went out in boxes. So we're very, very lucky that way.
Yeah, and a lot of people love following you on Instagram. I do know that. So social media has been a saviour for the likes of yourself.
Thanks be to God. Like many, many people, you know. And our sales went up last year as a result. But it's different plants. So some plants, not every plant, of course, will go in a box off to Cork or Donegal. So some plants we had to cut back in production because they were just bought visually and by eye. But many other plants, of course, travel quite happily.
How did you get interested in gardening and nature and all what you're doing here?
Born in Virginia, a good few years ago now, Damien. I suppose at seven I got a carpentry set for Christmas, and I took the Christmas tree out after Christmas, cut the bottom of it with my nice small carpentry set saw, planted it in the neighbour's garden, and it grew. So this was my first rooted cutting. So from that we moved on and opened here in 1986. My father had bought this field way back in the 60s, and we annexed it and pushed his cows one side and developed a nursery here. And at that stage it was tough going. Of course, there was interest rates that anybody remember a business that's at 19, 20 and 21% on overdrafts, which was shocking.
So what else is going on here? We're moving on down now.
Moving on down. Everything, of course, coming into flower. The girls are running around, of course, getting ready for packing and getting ready all our orders out today for the country. Some days up to 100 orders out of all sorts of things. And now we're growing plants, not only for the customer coming in, the walk-in customer, but plants that are able to go into a box and travel, because we have to shrink the size of the pot and in an awful lot of cases work on square pots that pack an awful lot easier. Yeah. So things have changed in the year that's gone.
All right, we continue walking along here now. I'm surrounded here by colours and plants and flowers and vegetables and seeds and moss and
all things earthly, Damien.
All
definitely.
Things earthly as
of course,
well.
Veg plants, we've most of them are grown now in what we call little peat blocks. that make life easier.
Yeah.
And it means we don't have to have any plastic pots. You can see the little peat block. We have little blocking machines. And they just root like that. And this lettuce plant, which is a little butterhead lettuce, it just goes out into your garden. The area is dug over. And that block is left sitting on the soil. And it roots in. And it's off the soil a little bit, that its base doesn't get dirty and messy then as a result. So I suppose in our veg area here, we have some lovely curly leaf parsley ready for the home gardener to plant out. Some nice sugar peas, lettuce in all types, some cabbage over here. And so slowly, bit by bit, and strawberries. And this is wonderful. When you look at the flower here, Damien, and you have the flower, and there's the baby strawberry starting to form in the middle of the flower, after it's been pollinated by a bee. And of course there's a huge interest in bees and pollinators, and we sell many, many plants that are important for our bees and pollinators as well. This is a big problem, that plants have to be grown in a proper way, because it's dreadful to see some plants that have been grown full of chemicals, full of neonics, and bees are visiting those plants and ending up in trouble. All our plants here in Pagoda Nurseries are grown in as natural a way as possible, but it's very important to look after our bee pollination. You know, pollination is so important. All our bees, our pollinators, our butterflies, we have many, many plants that they really adore.
Right, what other fruit can we grow, or what other fruits do you grow here?
The range of fruit that you can grow as a home gardener is fantastic. You know, the obvious ones would be apples, pears, plums, damsons, greengages, blackcurrants, gooseberries, raspberries, loganberries, tayberries, blueberries, peaches, nectarines, apricots, kiwis and grapes. And kiwi, in some cases, you need male and female plants. So the, again, our bees will pollinate the kiwi flowers, which are beautiful. But you will need a polythene tunnel or a greenhouse to be able to grow them inside. The same with your peaches, nectarines, apricots. Yeah. But for your blackcurrants, gooseberries, raspberries, ordinary outdoor spaces would be quite fine. And then we have dwarf ones, because gardens, as you know yourself, and you're living in an area with not enormous gardens, Damien, but
I'm beside one big one, the Phoenix Park.
You are, yes. But there's a dwarf, we have a nice dwarf apple tree here that will only grow around 4 feet high. It will grow in a container and crop very, very well.
Right.
So there are fruit that will grow in restricted places. And you can grow fruit on walls as well, so your wall spaces can be used up with plums and pears trained on the wall as well. So, and they look, they flower in spring, of course, like a flowering cherry does, and of course you have the benefit of fruit then as well. And of course, you can see roses all starting to come into leaf now. When you look at roses, you know, the range of leaf colours in roses is wonderful. You know, you have this very fine fern-like green leaf on this one here, and then you go for deep red foliage and green foliage. So as well as flower, you know, foliage can be important.
Gardening is an all year round business, but for a lot of people it's around now that they start thinking about getting out into the garden. Would that be fair to say? It is the busy time.
Yeah, longer days, fair weather gardeners will come out at this time of the year. Soil is getting a little bit drier. Most people haven't even a pair of Wellingtons or boots at home, you know, so they need decent soil to work in. And of course this time of the year you can have great fun planting hanging baskets and window boxes stuffed with colour, and you can grow vegetables and fruit in containers as well if you want to. So starting off that way is wonderful. You've got to be careful, of course, as well, that you're not tempted sometimes to buy plants that have been forced on. And when you bring them home, and of course I'd be conscious in the last couple of weeks we're getting lots of phone calls about an awful lot of people who have brought hydrangeas in places full leaf, full flower, bring them home, and next thing they get a nice frost and they're in trouble. So you're going to have successes and failures. So if the plant dies, they're living things, don't be broken hearted about it. Get another one, learn from the experience and move on and enjoy it. So gardening, of course, is a wonderful exercise. It's keeping you in touch with soil, and then you have the challenge of growing things, and you have the joy of achieving something at the end of it. So it's wonderful, because in the same garden you can have grandparents, grandchildren in the same area.
Well, did my generation lose touch with nature?
There was a little bit of that, Damien, where you missed out maybe on a grandparent showing you, or he was bringing you out to the garden, your grandfather wanted you to help him weed, and you kind of ran away as soon as you could. But then all of a sudden you wondered, how did he grow onions? How did he grow potatoes? And wouldn't it be wonderful to have him now to ask? So there is a bit of a gap there. Remember, nobody's looking at you. That's your excuse to scratch in the earth. It's an excuse to play in the soil. So main thing is enjoy it for the years ahead.
Yeah, I can hear it in your voice and I can see it in your face. And have a great summer, and let's hope when things open up again that you'll be back busy here for the next few months. Thanks very much, Joel.
Thank you, Damien.
That was the lovely Donal McAvoy there in Virginia. And if you're on Instagram, he's a great man for posting little video tips. And for those that follow him, yes, his business partner, Peter the Robin, is still very much in business there at Pagola Nurseries. But he was hiding yesterday when I went to visit. Now, in a year where many of us have newfound appreciation for the simple pleasures in life, such as gardening, it is perhaps no coincidence that the winners of the 2021 Irish Food Writers Guild Food Awards this week were some of our most basic but best loved foods. Potatoes from Ballymakenny Farm in County Louth and butter from County Down being two of the recipients. Suzanne Campbell joins us now to talk us through the winners and what's been a challenging year for many small food businesses. Good morning, Suzanne.
Good morning, Damien. Yes, it was a wonderful week for food this week. The awards took place on Thursday. The Food Writers Guild Awards, they're actually in their 27th year now, which is amazing. With the purpose, at the heart of it is to award local Irish producers and food heroes, which the writers and journalists in the Guild think are the best products and most outstanding people of the year. And this year, the awards were virtual, of course, but the Irish Drink Award went to Kinsale for a crafted mead flavoured with blackberries and cherries. And then they also have an Outstanding Achievement Award, and that went to one of Ireland's leading cheesemakers, Marion Rovald of Killeen Farmhouse Cheese in Galway, would be very well known. They also have an Environmental Award, which went to Ballymore Organics in Kildare. They grow organic porridge oats and make stone ground flour and semolina. Now, in a year that saw so many food companies move online to survive, and like your nursery there, it was so important, those online sales. It was a virtual farmers market called Neighbour Food that connects customers to a network of local producers that received the Outstanding Organisation Award from the Guild. Now, Neighbour Food was set up by a Cork market trader called Jack Crotty, and he had a business, maybe people would know it down that way, called Rocket Man at Markets. And I first asked him about what it felt like to receive the awards.
We were incredibly chuffed with the awards, and they're amazing awards, and they're very well recognised, and the other names in the list who've won the other awards kind of prove that. So I suppose we were really honoured and incredibly grateful. What we are is an open marketplace for small food producers to sell direct to the public. But obviously, it's a little bit logistically tricky with food. So what we do is we create collection points in communities. We have almost 60 now between Ireland and the UK. And the idea being that a producer can join into a local collection point, become part of the offering of that community, and then the customers can shop from everybody who's dropping into that collection.
When did the network begin and why did you begin it? What was your reason for starting it?
Well, we started in 2018, just at the end. The inspiration for it came from the fact that I was a farmers market trader myself. And I noticed the shift that many people weren't so much buying vegetables, bread, milk, eggs as much, but farmers markets were becoming more of a place to take a break, to socialize, for people to meet outdoors, eat nice food. But it was a difficult way to do your full weekly shop because there's a lot of people there. There's a lot of queues. There's a lot of, you know, individual transactions with all the different producers. So the idea for Neighbour Food was to try and streamline the actual grocery shopping aspect of it, because those types of producers were not seeing the markets as a growing opportunity for them. People who are interested in buying local food were going to farmers markets and buying bits and pieces, but they weren't filling their fridge. So the idea of Neighbour Food was to try and let people be able to do that, because we still have all of those producers in Ireland, but it was becoming harder and harder to be able to access them.
Neighbour Food, check it out online. They have several hubs in many of the counties that you can collect food from. It's absolutely brilliant. Another organisation called Green Schools won the Food Writers Guild Community Award for 2021, and they launched a two-year programme in schools that aims to teach crucial food skills to children. Their food award from the Guild went to Ballymakenny Farm Speciality Potatoes. Now, we've had Maria Flynn up there from near Turnfechan on the programme before. You might remember she's a fantastic grower, and they were growing commercial potatoes, herself and her husband and her family. And they just switched to growing speciality varieties because it was just too difficult price-wise to do commercial potatoes anymore. And she was thriving, but then selling into restaurants primarily this year, they had to really adapt what they were doing.
It's an award I hugely respect, and it gave me the boost I needed to get going again. So it was fantastic. Growing potatoes in Ireland is not a new concept. And that is what we do. We grow potatoes. We looked to grow something a little bit different. We wanted to give people a choice, to give chefs particularly a choice, because they were our market of what they had to cook with, and really to get people talking about potatoes again and not just have them as a filler-upper, to talk about flavours and textures and taste, the way we were doing that with all of these other different foods, but never about potatoes. Chefs were our main market. So with the onset of COVID, that changed rapidly, and we had to search for a retail market for our lovely potatoes.
And how difficult was that?
Like everybody else, we were thrown into this.
Yeah.
And I just reacted by opening a small drive-through spud shack at the gates of our farm. It's not the same business model as we had before. And there's another chunk in the chain in terms of price. So, you know, it's not the fairy story I'd like it to be.
Yeah.
But I take the good out of it. And the good news is we had tons of potatoes and we managed to get rid of them. And for that, I am eternally grateful. You know, we still have headaches. It's still not the ideal. We still really want our chefs back. But we just have to take the good out of the situation. And the good is that we managed to sell our potatoes in a really lovely environment that kept us, kept our headspace in a good place more than anything.
Yes. And in terms of planting, like for the coming season, did you plant less? That must be really difficult to work out if your food service market has collapsed.
I'm petrified, not going to lie. We had to have a big conversation recently about, you know, will we bother? Because we grow some speciality veg as well.
Mm.
And there was a big conversation around that. And will we do it or won't we? And we're doing it. Is it the right thing to do? I don't know, Suzanne. It's the same with the potatoes. We're planting the same again, but this year will really be, I'm worried about it. I'm not going to lie. I'm very worried.
Right.
I have to give it another chance. We've put so much work into it, you know, but our chefs have gone.
Okay, and that was Maria Flynn there talking about some of the challenges as well. Now, you can hear there the real dilemma in Maria's voice when, I suppose, talking about, you know, getting sowing for the year ahead and the high cost and high risk in, operation that's involved. Now, I know, Suzanne, you also spoke to Kirsten Jensen, chairperson of the Irish Food Writers Guild, about what types of food they awarded this year and if they had a common theme.
Our winners this year are really interesting in that they all fall under this umbrella of going back to basics. We have potatoes, we have spiced beef, we have mead, we have butter. You can't get more basic than that. So for the year that's in it, it's interesting to be able to reflect on those kinds of core ingredients that are the staple of so many of our most favorite dishes.
And talking to Maria there up in Louth, the potato producer, it's very meaningful in tough times to get an award and to get that accolade, because a lot of small producers have had difficult years as well.
Absolutely. And that's one of the most rewarding parts of these awards for the Guild, that because as a food producer or an organization, you can't nominate yourself. All the nominations are from within the Guild and they're all done secretly. We all pay for our own products to bring to the tasting meeting. These people have no idea when they get the letter from us. It's coming out of the blue. It's a complete surprise. And the reactions are all overwhelmingly really quite humbling for us as Guild members to see how much they mean to people to get these awards. They're really well regarded.
And also by shining a light on these products, it alerts consumers to them as well and gives them a wider audience.
Absolutely. And that is one of the goals of these awards, trying to introduce as many people as possible to these products. And another silver lining of the pandemic is that many more of these types of foods are now available online. Either producers have set up their own websites, you know, super quickly, doing it practically overnight, or they've been able to piggyback on other organizations, such as one of our other award winners, Neighbor Food. So luckily, the availability is only getting better and better, I think, as time goes on.
And that was Kirsten Jensen, chairperson of the Irish Food Writers Guild, ending that report there from Suzanne Campbell. And congratulations to all of the winners.
RTE Radio 1. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Have you cattle to sell? Find out what they're worth with our March price calculator on farmersjournal.ie.
A new report has been published this morning on the future direction of Ireland's agri-food sector. It's the work of the 2030 Agri-Food Committee under the chairmanship of agri-economist and public policy advisor Tom Arnold. It's a roadmap aimed at managing the entire farm-to-fork process efficiently in protecting the environment and farm incomes while consolidating global markets. And its aim is for Ireland to be a world leader in sustainable food systems over the next decade. Among the targets are for carbon neutral farming by 2050, the setting aside of 10% of farmland for biodiversity by 2030, increasing the value of global food exports from 13 billion to 21 billion by the end of the decade. And the next step is a public consultation process which will be open for the next 2 months, and it begins on Wednesday with a series of webinars. Well, with me now to go through some of this is the Minister for Agriculture, Food and the Marine, Charlie McConnellogue. Minister, good morning. This sector is falling down with reports, including your own Ag Climatise proposal, your 75-point action plan launched earlier this week, the EU Green Deal farm-to-fork strategy, not to mention the new CAP reform. So where does this new Agri-Food 2030 strategy fit into all of that?
Good morning, Damien, and listen, firstly, I want to thank Tom Arnold for his tremendous work as chairman, working with all of the members of the 2030 Strategy Group. And I think what's very unique about this approach, and it has served agriculture very well for since the year 2000, when we first started these 10-year reports, what serves it really well is the fact that it brings together all within the agri-food sector and all stakeholders. And they have ownership in terms of the direction that the sector takes. And I think that has been very productive and worked really well for us. And I think it can work really well as well in terms of bringing our ag food sector forward now, between now and 2030. The approach that the committee are taking is quite different to the previous reports, in that it's taking a food systems approach to how we develop agri-food domestically over the next 10 years. And that means that in terms of how we actually produce food, we not only look at the food production aspect of it, but we look at how it interacts with health and also with the wider environment, and ensuring that those three things are taken in conjunction. And I think that very much fits in as well to the direction of travel worldwide in relation to the approach towards food. And also, for example, the UN Food Summit taking place later this year, which yes, is trying to lead in terms of developing food systems approach internationally. And I think that can work very well in terms of for our farmers, primary producers and our food sector domestically. And really importantly, and most importantly as well, for all of us who consume food and for whom food is essential to all our lives, and how it is produced is really important to us too.
Now, it is very ambitious, very detailed, but there seems on the face of it to be some conflicts in the ambition. For example, there's a target to grow our exports to 21 billion euros by 2030, and then there's the target to reduce methane by 10% in the same time. Surely they're mutually exclusive. How can you achieve both?
Well, I think it is possible to achieve both, and I think the committee, which brings together expertise from all aspects of the agri-food and research sector, has looked at this in great detail, and the focus is going to be on ensuring that we try and develop as much of a premium aspect to our food as we possibly can, so that we look at how we enhance its value. And in terms of how we actually grow the capacity of our ag food sector to increase its production, that is done in a way that is sustainable and is smart and climate and environmentally smart as well. And you referenced there in your introduction the Ag Climatise document, which I published earlier on at the start of this year, which outlines how agri-food sector can actually make its contribution to climate change over the next period of time, which also, of course, will be considered in the context of the new Climate Action Bill as well. But that outlines how by increasing soil fertility, for example, by ensuring that we use nutrients much more smartly in terms of organic fertiliser, right, and also chemical fertiliser, how we use pesticides, that in terms of actually using that in the most intelligent way possible, there is significant capacity there to reduce our overall climate footprint while continuing to produce exceptionally healthy and safe food, not only for consumers across our own country, but internationally as well, because we do have to to remember that we export 90% of what we produce, and that's significant internationally and also very significant in terms of the contribution it makes to our economy and to employment as well.
Yeah, now that green transition is very achievable, but the FAO and the OECD quoted in the report as saying that food prices will stay stable or reduce slightly in the coming years. Isn't that the nub of the issue from a farmer's perspective, that consumers don't want to pay for the privilege of sustainable food and the cost that will be involved in that green transition?
I think, I mean, central to the report and certainly central to my own mission as Minister for Agriculture is to ensure that farm incomes and primary producer incomes are central to public policy, and that we try and support those in every way we can, because at the end of the day, that it's farmers and primary producers who our food system and our food sector is built upon. So I think in terms of how we actually approach the environmental objectives over the next period of time, that there can be opportunities for new income streams there, because farmers do have a leadership role to play and are up for playing a leadership role in relation to, for example, tackling biodiversity, and also very much so in terms of playing making their contribution to reducing our climate or emissions. But in doing so, I think it's really important that we take a partnership approach and the farmers are rewarded for the work on the environmental goods that they will produce.
Yep. Yep.
So incomes have to be absolutely crucial and central. And in terms of public policy, that certainly will be the approach that will be taken. And I think this report very much takes that approach and sets a very strong leadership direction for the next 10 years with incomes and economic sustainability at its heart.
OK, well, speaking of which, the environmental pillar, as you know, representing a number of environmental NGOs, they pulled out of this strategy committee earlier this year, saying that the report was, quote, woefully inadequate to meet the social and environmental challenges we face. And in a week where we hear that 63% of Ireland's wild bird species are now of serious conservation concern, with intensive farming partly to blame in that, have their concerns been addressed in this draft report?
I think certainly this is a report which is really does address the need for agriculture and food to be environmentally sustainable and to set a direction which ensures that it will be as well. I was very much disappointed that the environmental pillar representative didn't stay there to the finalisation of this document. And I certainly think this is a document which is a very balanced one and which is a very environmentally sustainable one as well. It is really important now over the next period of time that we do see strong engagement in the consultation process that's now commencing on this strategy. It's a draft strategy at the moment. It's going out for public consultation from today for a period of 8 weeks. And certainly I look forward to the environmental pillar engaging in that public consultation, but also the wider public engaging in it, because food is really important to all of us. How it's produced is really important to all of us.
Sure.
And this 10-year strategy sets the course for that. So I would encourage all members of the public over the next 8 weeks to feed into that through the consultation process by making submissions, and also through the food systems dialogues that we will be that you indicated and mentioned that will be happening over the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
As well to inform and bring forward the ideas and policies outlined in this 10-year strategy.
Okay, a couple of final points. Farm groups and environmental advocates, they've been, you know, at one in their ambivalence both about each other and in the future direction of Irish food production and where it should go. How destructive is that rather poor relationship for all of our good?
I think it's important that we work to ensure that relationship is one of partnership, because I think all of us, first of all, have to work together to make progress. And I think everybody needs to recognise what farmers actually are contributing in terms of producing top quality food in a very environmentally sustainable way by international standards, based on our grass-fed system domestically, for example, and also the potential and willingness and openness of farmers to provide leadership in this in the time ahead as well, to continue to produce that top quality food, but to do it in a way that takes every step possible in terms of ensuring that it's environmentally sustainable and making a contribution providing leadership in relation to biodiversity and improving or addressing our biodiversity decline as well.
Yeah,
so I think there has to be a recognition of that, and certainly I recognise that as Minister, and I think increasingly through this approach of people coming together, and hopefully through the finalisation of their support and engagement, we'll see around that we can help ensure that there is everyone does work together,
sure,
to address what is undoubtedly big challenge for us in the years ahead.
All right, we've a minute left, and obviously there's lots more I'd like to get through, and we will come back to this in a couple of months' time with you. But EPA figures show that the decline in water, air and soil quality is due a lot to dairy expansion. Is capping or reducing cow numbers the only way to reverse this decline? And for a dairy farmer that's listening to us now, what will they be doing in 2030?
I think how we use our how we maximise the potential of our soil and soil health, and also how we use nutrients smartly, for example, in relation to organic fertiliser and the use of chemical fertiliser. There can be a lot done in relation to that can actually ensure we improve water quality and also improve the efficiency of agriculture. And I think overall, Damien, you know, we're going to see the world population increase to 8.5 billion by 2030 and 10 billion by 2050, and the world is going to have to be fed. We can massively contribute to that domestically by producing food in a very environmentally sustainable manner. Yeah. But it's really important that we do build on the track record we have and maximise that further in the time ahead, and ensure that from an environmental point of view as well as an economic, yeah, point of view, we maximise the possibilities and capacity of our ag food sector.
All right. Minister for Agriculture, Food and the Marine, Charlie McConnell, thank you indeed for joining us this morning. That report being published today, it goes live. All of us can get involved and give our opinion on it. So if you go onto the Department of Agriculture website, you will be able to follow a link there. And we will monitor this and we will come back to it during that process and indeed at the end of it in 8 weeks' time. Yes, well, that's the sound of the curlew. But this bird with long legs and distinctive curved back beak, of course, is rarely seen nowadays, because over the last 30 years, this ground nesting bird has seen a 96% decline in numbers. And as we've been speaking about there earlier this week, we've been hearing a quarter of Ireland's wild bird species are at risk of extinction. Now, in the run-up to World Curlew Day on the 21st of April, Hannah Quinn Mulligan met with Kerry farmer Tim O'Donoghue and the team from the National Parks and Wildlife Service, who run the curlew conservation programme at a former Bord na Mona bog in Liara Crompain in County Kerry, looking for the elusive curlew.
Been out all day looking to see where they see a curlew, and the curlews are gone very, very scarce in this area.
Because I remember growing up as a child on a farm, and I don't think I've ever heard a curlew, but you were saying they were always around when you were a child.
Oh, they were always around when I was a child. I remember finding the first nest. I was 6 years old. I found the first nest. It's only about a mile down the road here from me at the moment, and I can still see the eggs and the way they were. But by God, I tell you now, you would have a job to find the nest now, because, you know, it's... They're very, very scarce at the moment anyway, you know.
And what do they look like?
Well, they're a wader. The most distinguished things that I can see is the long bill. It's a long bill, and you have the male and the female. The female is the female will be much bigger than the male. And the curlew sound, of course, you know, they kind of... You know, like that call like that. And you could... A beautiful call, and something that we don't want, we miss from the mountainside. It's an awful pity, like, you know, that we have that it's more or less gone from the mountainside, because they were so nice to hear. And unfortunately, there are so many things with predators in between foxes and badgers, and you know, you have grey crows, which will, you know, hooded crows, which will take the eggs as well. And you know, there's fire in, of course, and the fire is the killer of all species, you know, because when a fire, somebody cracks a match, and especially in the evening, you know, they'll crack it late in the evening, and it has burned acres of mountain, and then it burns all types of habit, all types of bird life, meadow pipits, skylarks, you know, hen harrier nests, you know, because they nest on the ground as well, and of course the curlew.
And your land that you're farming now at the minute, that's involved in this curlew conservation project that's run,
yeah,
by the National Parks and Wildlife Service. Mm. I mean, what do you have to do for that as part
of
that scheme?
Well, a part of it would be to put out a certain amount of lime, and then I suppose, you know, there's a certain amount of rushes that you know, that you could cut, not them all, you know, because they can feed him, they feed him. But you see, the thing about it is that, you know, they're getting so scarce now, it is nearly impossible. I know the department have put and Barry has put an awful big effort into the Huber, and you know, we're only hoping, and you know, hoping against hope that we'll get them back here again. You know.
And you mentioned there Barry and Huber, and we're lucky to have them both here in the bog with us from the National Parks and Wildlife Service. Barry O'Donoghue, you're passionate about the curlew as well and this conservation project.
You know, I was watching the Jack Charlton piece there recently, and you know, thinking back to Paddy Bonner saving that penalty in Genoa, and I think it was the 25th of June in 1990. That day, outside our windows, when we were all watching the television, there was about 5,000 pairs of curlew breeding in Ireland. And today we're looking at just no more than 150 pairs. So you're looking at about a 96% decline in about 30 years, which is astronomical. It's absolutely crazy. It's like if the entire human population of Ireland disappeared and all that was left were those people that were living in Cork City. And as you can imagine, as a Kerry man, that's an appalling vista. So, in all seriousness, we're looking at a drastic situation with the birds.
Part of that conservation project, there's another man we should say here in the Bord na Mona Bog with us, and that's Hubert Sauvignon.
So I'm currently the Curlew Conservation Programme Project Manager. Across Ireland, we're covering 9 different areas. Some areas have 2 or 3 counties bordering them, you know, like in the Orkneys, where you're bordering Clare and Galway, or Lochry, which borders Roscommon, Westmeath.
And if this was a GAA match, what are the tables like? Who's in the lead and who's falling behind?
The lead is very much the people that are on islands. Curlew actually stands a chance on islands because of the predation.
Yeah. And it's an interesting part of Kerry that you find yourself in, because I heard that it's a John B. Keane country as well. Are you familiar with John B. Keane?
Yes, I am. Yeah, I'm actually married locally. I've lived here.
Harrier there.
Oh, there's a hen harrier there as we going across, gliding across as we speak.
Oh, wow. I've never seen a hen harrier before.
Oh, well.
In real life, no. He's so elegant, like he's this beautiful sort of dusky grey with these black wingtips.
It's like they're floating along some invisible stream.
I'm from the county next door and I've never seen a hen harrier in my life, and I've never seen a curlew in my life. So is that part of the reason, Barry, why this part of the world is so important?
It is, yeah. It's actually protected as a special protection area as well. It's of European importance. And, you know, like you say, we're just after seeing the hen harrier, and the reason why we love the hen harrier is not just in himself, or not just because of his sky dance or the food passes is spectacular, but more so that he's actually an indicator species. He'd be at the top of the food chain here. So, you know, if you've got hen harriers, that's an indication that you've got the different trophic levels, the different levels of the food web beneath him as well, like, you know. So, yeah, he's an indicator for the overall health of the landscape and the ecosystem and biodiversity at large here. So it's great that we still have hen harriers hanging on here in this landscape. It is, yeah.
I think it happened when we invoked the name John B. Keane. So someone or something must have been listening. But you were saying, actually, that we're not too far away from the field that inspired John B. Keane's famous play of the same name.
That's right, yeah. There was a murder, I think it was back in the 1950s, and of course back in Ireland back in that day, that was an absolutely massive national story. And you know, John B. Keane would have spent all of his summers out here in Lara Campan and Stax Mountains, and it's where he would have got his inspiration for a lot of his work. And you know, that play The Field, which went on to become the great film as well, would have been inspired by real life events here, where there was a man killed over land. And you know, it was over the fact that one neighbour had moved in the fence maybe only a few feet in on the other man's land. And you know, you're talking about really kind of wet, rushy mountain ground that wasn't worth a whole lot, but nonetheless, of course, we all know that land and land ownership, you know, runs really deep here in Ireland. But you fast forward maybe 50 or 60 years now to today, and that field is now under Sitka spruce forestry. You know, it's been planted, there's nobody managing it, it's all gone. And I suppose that to me is kind of the moral of the story, that, you know, we're all just passing through in this world, really, like, you know. And the land, you know, we need to look after it, and what it holds, and whether that be the curlew or the grouse or the hen harrier or whatever, they're all birds that shared our landscape with our grandparents, and, you know, something that is part of Ireland that is diminishing and disappearing before our very eyes, you know.
So there'll never be a curlew on the field?
No, curlew don't fit in with the spruce forestry whatsoever. And in fact, not just alone with the immediate footprint of the forestry, but for a kilometre or more around that forestry, it can have negative impacts in terms of its potential for predation. You know, if you're a ground nesting bird and nesting close to a forestry plantation, you're infinitely more likely to be predated, your nest. You know, the eggs could be taken or the chicks could be taken.
You know, we have another common agricultural policy coming up where there's lots of talk about more individualised schemes for local areas. Are you hoping that there's going to be more money set aside for the curlew and other conservation projects?
If you've got a locally laid programme with teams on the ground working hand in hand with the farmers, advising the agri advisors as well, working on a needs must basis in terms of not just having a one size fits all approach, but you know, getting down on the ground, working with the farmers, saying, look, this is what needs to happen in this field. In this field, you know, that's okay, you don't need to do much there. Or in this field, look, they're actually nesting in this field, maybe we'll hold off on cutting the silage a little bit later or whatever. You know, getting down onto site specific, I think that's really a very positive way to approach agri environment schemes. Like, you know, and I think the farmers appreciate that too, because it's more appropriate for their land and it makes sense as well, like, you know.
And Tim, you had your binoculars there. I'm going to pull you away from the hen harrier for a minute. I mean, what would it mean to you if you looked out and were able to see a curlew just the way we saw a hen harrier?
Oh my God, it'd mean an awful lot, you know, because if they're gone out of here, they're gone out of here and they won't be back in a hurry. But I think that there's a change in attitude now, a huge change in attitude with the farmers, a younger generation which are more educated and are more interested in the environment. And we had plenty of hen harriers, you know, over the years. I remember we had up to 18 pairs around here at one stage. Now you'd be lucky if we had 4 to 5 pairs. But yet we have a lot more hen harriers than we have curlew. And, you know, you'd be only hoping that the curlew would return. You know, it would make a big difference to all of us, you know.
Hannah Quinn Mulligan talking there about the curlew in Laragh Crumpáin in County Kerry yesterday. Now, as you travel around your county in your newfound freedom from lockdown, you notice the fields will be more alive now over the next few days, with bucking cattle enjoying their new freedom after being indoors for the winter. And next week, you'll be noticing inter-county footballers leaping for joy as well on the training fields as they get back to inter-county training. Among them, John Heslin in Westmeath. John, good morning.
Hi, Damien. How are things?
You'll be experiencing both this week. First of all, how did the herd test go yesterday on your dad's farm?
Yeah, we had a clear test, thank God. Certainly a nervous time of year. My heart goes out to anyone who has suffered from positive tests, but luckily we had a clear test.
That's great. So are the cattle clear now to get out and onto the grass?
Yeah, they're out of grass now. We're looking forward to the warm weather forecast this week to help the grass grow.
Yeah. Has that been a bit of a problem? There's been a lot of frost. I met a man when I was talking to the nursery earlier, giving out that he can't grow anything because of the frost. Is it the same with the grass?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just listening to Minister for Agriculture, Charlie McConnellogue there, you know, he talks about our system and out of grass. And us farmers are trying to do our best, you know, but we're at the helm of the weather. And that's the way it's been this spring. It's certainly been a late spring, but we'll try and remain positive, obviously, because there are bigger issues out there at the moment.
Yeah, and all those reports I was talking about as well, is that a headache for farmers trying to navigate your way through all of those?
Look, I suppose it is, but it's the changing nature of agriculture. You know, there's more obstacles and more hurdles, and you know, farmers are able to get through a lot of it, but they certainly need assistance and guidance. And, you know, by times farmers are getting more stressed and fed up with it. But look, that's the changing market. There are structures in place. You know, the minister mentioned a number of people who are doing a lot of work behind the scenes. And hopefully the industry can meet the demands of the consumer.
Yeah. Well, listen, John, I'm glad to hear that the herd test is just good to touch in with you to get a reflection of how farmers are feeling at this point. It's a lovely time of the year if you're a cattle farmer looking at the cattle all going out. But briefly as well, you're getting back training this week.
back training. We have a clear test. We have three more cows to calve, and looking forward. If the GA season was this schedule every year, it would certainly suit the calving season. That's for sure.
All right. Well, hopefully it won't be, if you know what I mean. That we'll never have to go through this again. But listen, look forward to chatting to you, John. Best of luck in the league and the championship. And delighted to hear that the cattle passed the TB test. And like many farmers, you're letting the cattle back out to grass for a long, hopefully warm summer ahead. John Heslin, thanks very much indeed. Our great friend Johanique van der Bosch in Holland, who listens in every week, says, Countrywide, it's like going on holiday on your radio. Well, that's a nice way to put it. And we were certainly all over the country today, because that's all we have time for this week. Today's programme is produced by Eileen Herron. Brian Moss was our broadcast coordinator. Rue Kennington on sound. Stay tuned for playback here on Radio 1 after the 9 news. Until I talk to you at the same time next week, mind yourself, bye-bye, and thanks for listening.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by the Irish Farmers Journal. Have you cattle to sell? Find out what they're worth with our Mart Price Calculator on farmersjournal.ie.
RTE Radio 1.